Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry Podcast, episode 108. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, sleeper hits and comedy awards. Rob Kemp is the creator of the show The Elvis Dead. This show has won or been nominated for over a dozen awards, including the Leicester Comedy Festival Awards Best Show, Best Musical Show and Best Poster, the Edinburgh Comedy Awards Best Newcomer Award, Chortle's Best Newcomer for Music and Variety Act, and so many more. After so much success, how has this changed Rob's career? How is he dealing with the pressure of writing a follow-up hour? Which awards have made the biggest impact on his career and on his life? And what's the future for the Elvis Dead show? This is an in-depth look into what it is like to get a lot of success in a very short space of time. But, and by the way, by short space of time, I mean like over the course of about 18 months. It's not like nobody is an overnight success. It's just he got it all very quickly for an amazing show, which I've seen a few times, and it's outstanding. But to get that amount of attention in what is relatively a short space amount of time, what boosted his career the most? What made the biggest impact? How did the awards help sell a show, if they did at all? This is going to be an interesting look into what actually makes a difference outside of the Edinburgh bubble and in the life of the performer and their career as a whole. If you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to leave us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. 5 stars would be great, but if not, a 4-star rating with a review that reads like a 5-star is just as good. And either way, please do remember to join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast and it's on Facebook, obviously. Before I hit play on the podcast, I just want to say that I have signed up for the Edinburgh Festival and I am currently previewing a show around the country. I won't go on about where and when that's going to be right now, but if you want to take a look in the show notes and have a look and see where I'm going to be previewing and where I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival, that would be great. I really appreciate seeing some of your faces at these shows. It's always lovely to have the audience come down and say, hey, it's me, I'm the person who tweets you, or hi, I'm a regular listener and I love it. So if you could come down to a show, that'd be really appreciated, and or the Edinburgh Festival. And if you're not able to come down, if you could just pass on the message to a friend who's in the area, that'd be massively, massively appreciated. And I can't thank you enough for the support. But for now, this is Rob Kemp.
Using my words.
Okay.
From my face. Yeah, I am using my face. Voice. Yes.
Cool.
You're not nearly as close as me. Why is that?
Because my levels are higher, because I naturally go quite higher in this. Right, you don't need to know this, but like for the edit, my voice always seems to go higher in the thing. So I always try and get everyone else's level slightly lower so it doesn't peak. I edit a lot of me out of this. So I'm not really relevant. Like, I'm genuinely like, you know, how much have you listened to? A few, I assume.
I've listened to a couple. So, a couple of early ones, if I'm honest.
Yeah, they're not the best.
No. If I'm honest, it's not. It's purely out of finding that window to sit and listen to any podcast. Yeah, to be honest, you know, I've got. They're all accumulating, like ComComPod and all the other ones. They're accumulating, and I just don't get the chance to. You know.
Yeah, I get that. Also, if you see me adjusting it,
don't try and help me by moving the mic or changing your volume. It's just because I'm,
All right. I'm a passenger. I appreciate that.
That's all right. The way I'm, seeing this one going is like, I don't know if you heard this one because it was episode 10, so it was an early one, but it might pass you by. Louisa O'Malley was someone who I had booked before Edinburgh when she was doing What Would Beyonce Do?
Yeah.
And then it just went mental. And then I could only sort of get her afterwards. And it changed, like the reason for that pod kind of changed because obviously it just from like day two went mental for her and became a bit of a cult following and like a bit of a bigger thing than I think she expected.
So this time you're getting someone who had a big year and is about to squander it.
Yeah, basically, yeah. No, I'm wondering how it's affected your career, how it's affected the show and what it's like being in that whirlwind of doing really well. But I mean, I even joke a lot about how, you know, PRs have managed to make the comedy like the newcomer award, because that's essentially like saying you're the employee of the month. Like in my head, that's basically a rebranded employee of the month sticker.
I know
it's not, but because I never win it, I will have a go at it.
I happen to think it's extremely prestigious, and to even be in the running is is a high honour, and I won't hear anything said to denigrate the
award you won.
The award I well, and the ones I didn't.
Of course.
Oh God, it's awful. Whenever somebody in asks you how the comedy's going, and they've got no idea, and then you're kind of somewhere between, well, you have asked, and you evidently are interested. So I've got license to tell you about accolades and things. Without being being self-indulgent.
Humble, like sarcastic.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not, you don't want to be going, then this happened. When in actual fact, if someone asks you directly, surely that's licensed to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I've never won as many awards as you, but I am aware of the frustration because you, especially family, I feel like when my family asked me how's the comedy going, like especially when I was entering competitions, and I was doing well in them, I'd be like, well, I'm in the final of this, or I'm in the semi-final of that. But then you sort of then feel like, not a dick, but like, they're so used to you going, yeah, I did this at 4 open mics this week, and it was awful, and no one was there, and that you know what I mean? Yeah. It's such a turnaround. I feel like they're a bit like, when did you start becoming good?
Oh. Yeah, well, no, exactly, yeah. It doesn't change anything in the mindset, because I mean now I'm of the opinion, that was your peak then. That was your, you got an award for a thing you did.
Yeah.
You know, it's not you broadly, it's not your work. It's weird, it's that whole, so you won one, prove it, win another.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a ridiculous way to work, but I recognize it in it's last year isn't apparently validation enough for my entire for me at least. I don't know what anybody else thinks, to be honest, because this, when you're saying what was it like, I was oblivious to most of it. I'm told later on that everybody was talking about the show, and I knew it was going well. Of course, I did. The room was filling and stuff, and every night went well, you know. But I didn't hear any of it. I didn't, and I suppose that's. But you, why would you talk to somebody about?
Yeah,
kind of does feel like being in the eye, you know,
of the storm.
The storm, like that. You're in the calm part, and you don't experience any of that. And also at the time I was staying with my then girlfriend who sort of lived in Edinburgh but out of Edinburgh. So I was a bus ride away, so the lateness of the show being midnight, and then you do your wind down, and then you by the time you realize anything it's 3 in the morning or something. I know that's sort of standard fringe time.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, I know. I'm not. Yes, I am a wuss. No. So it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, and then you go to bed, and then you have a decent night's sleep, and then you wake up, and it's at least lunchtime, and then you do all your getting up and washing of the costume and so on and so forth. And I really felt out of it. I really didn't feel too connected to the whole sort of festival last year. I sort of felt like I missed. And then, of course, there was the whole thing with my job and having to go back and do some work on certain days. I didn't experience the world, the hurricane. I was not oblivious to it, but distanced from it. Really weird. Maybe that's how it always is. I don't know. That was my first thing, you know. That wasn't a humble brag either. That wasn't.
No,
okay, I hit the ground running. Yeah. No, but I mean,
and I didn't even know it, guys. I was that good.
And I,
yeah.
I don't mean that.
How I'm going to edit this? You're going to sound so.
I'm going to sound so arrogant.
It's just going to be that one sentence where you go, "I just had a job. I had to balance my job." How many of you are doing that? How many of you have a job as well?
Yeah, guys. Raise your game.
Yeah.
And you're going to edit that one as well.
It's going to just be raise your game. Okay, right. Let's pause that for a second, right? And let's start with pre-show, right? So not as in like your pre-show ritual, as in before you were doing that. So like this is 2016. You haven't got this show now. Yeah. You're just, what? How would you describe your career at that point in comedy, not in your day job? I assume you had a day job then.
Yeah, I had a day job. Paid middles. I would close, you know, small, really small, often unpaid. You know, essentially new. I was trusted to close new material nights and things.
Humbling.
Well, you know, because my stand up is fairly left field. You may be surprised to hear that. You've seen me.
So how would you describe your stand up then at this time? So like, because this is obviously pre you taking on a cat. Do you see it as a character? Do you see it as an extension of you? How do you see the?
I don't know. What is it? It's who did a thing? Okay, it's like. This is not a good example. This is a terrible example. It's like William Shatner.
This is going to be good. Your face.
William Shatner recorded a record.
Okay.
But he's still William Shatner being and doing William Shatner.
Yeah, I get you. Okay.
So this is that. This is common people. You know?
Right.
I mean, I'm not trying to play it down. You know, it might well become... it might well become who and what I am, you know. It was because this show was written in a, as I say, I wasn't particularly going, didn't feel like I was going anywhere. I'd had a brush with the BBC New Comedy Award, and that was pretty much it up to that point. Gongs weren't my friend, and just in terms of style, you know, they didn't enjoy me there. I didn't feel like I was stagnating or anything, but I didn't feel like... I mean, there was definitely no pressure on me. There was definitely nobody watching me. And I think that was... So that was kind of why I just did I wrote a show that was really a... This is for me. This is for me and people like me, you know? And I didn't really give it any thought to whether it had any cultural appeal or...
Commercial viability.
It was like, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to do this thing because I've had an idea and I'm going to see it through, you know. Little did I know how much people would embrace it. I suppose, in hindsight, Elvis has a lot of fans.
He's got a few.
He's got
still.
One or two, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's got one or two.
Yeah,
I mean, never once, because at the start of the show, I do ask, has everybody heard of Elvis Presley? and not once has that question been greeted by silence. Everybody knows Elvis.
Yeah, everybody knows Elvis. Yeah.
So,
I mean,
So in hindsight, The Evil Dead 2 is one of the cultiest movies. And I make no apologies for it being a favourite of mine, you know. But then also I realise that it is one that a lot of people are going to enjoy, you know. So, as I say, in hindsight, it's it has way more commercial viability than I realised. You know, I didn't. It was never conceived for that.
Mm.
Well, of course it was. Nobody does any of this for. I mean, you've got to be like sort of some sort of eccentric billionaire to just go and do something for your own, for your own fancy.
Yeah.
I
know you. I mean, I've recently met people from like nearby schools to where I went to school. Like, you know, when you go back home and stuff, who were listening to the same albums and stuff that I was listening to, that I thought, oh, no one knows about this band, or no one knows about that. And you kind of feel a kindred with them because they've kind of not gone through the same thing, but they're kind of into the same thing.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I suppose that helps with the pull factor of getting people in the door, where they sort of see Elvis and Dead and then read the description and go, oh, these are two things, or at least one thing I like.
Yeah.
I'll give, yeah.
Although it does work if you don't like either. I just want to drop that in there.
Well, full disclosure, I've never seen Elvis live, just saying, and I've never seen The Evil Dead, and I saw your show and thought it was amazing. So without knowing anything about either, but I mean, you did save me time because the film's longer than your show.
It is longer.
So yeah, yeah.
It is longer, yeah.
So it was like the TLDR of of that film.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is.
So you've got a day job.
A day job.
It's 2016. Yep. You're middling at clubs in the
not
Midlands.
No disrespect to anywhere that I was doing, but it wasn't like
you weren't making money from.
I wasn't making. It was not a viable income source. It was covering my petrol maybe, or allowing me to continue doing it.
And what was your job then?
I worked in a school. I was examinations officer.
Okay. And that obviously works quite well for Edinburgh, like for summer holidays and things.
Except results days.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah. And no, I read about that. Yeah.
You get the 6 weeks, and although actually I was at a school prior to that, and you didn't get the same holidays.
Yeah.
So when I moved schools, I made a point of insisting that that was part of my contract, that I could have those weeks. I took a hit financially, but
it's worth it.
It meant that I could come do Edinburgh.
Of course.
Okay.
At what point did you either have the idea? Because I read that you didn't have the idea for the show. It was someone who mentioned it to you, and then you watched a film where they played. Has it become skewed in my head?
That's slightly skewed. It was my idea.
Okay. I'm not here to do the universal lawyer thing.
All right, I see. Did Ian send you?
Someone else write ideas, mate.
what it was, I saw a film called Bubba Hotep.
Have you
seen that?
I've not seen it, no. So you've watched a whole different canon of films to me, is what I'm getting the vibe of.
Yeah.
I was sitting there watching Back to the Future and repeating my teens.
No, snap. Yeah. I mean, I'm very much the 80s kid. You know, Ghostbusters is one of my favourite films, and so on and so forth.
Sorry, I was going to say, have you seen this is nothing relevant to the
podcast. Female one?
No. There's a Shakespearean parody version of it at the Fringe this year.
Is there?
Yeah, it's 11 a.m. so it's a bit early, but I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm on board for that.
Where is that?
I'll get you the details after.
Excellent.
Yeah, come with on the damn going. It's gonna be fucking amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm up for that.
The video of it is when they make their little TV spot.
Yes.
It's three people in Victorian wear holding sort of pretend guns, just going, if thou is spooked with a spectre during the night, hath thou had problems trying to sleep through? It's just like, oh. I'm like, oh, mate, this is bang on. This is exactly what I want. I want to know how you're going to do the Twinkie. I want to know how you're going to get Slimer involved. I want to know all of it. I don't care. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, awesome.
Yeah, yeah. My thing is films.
Like, there's no marshmallows in Shakespearean times.
Yeah, well, probably wasn't.
Then what is Goza going to become?
But there's no fridge, so he couldn't live in it anyway.
Oh, God. What? They've got so many problems.
I know. There's so many plot holes in this.
Oh, my word.
That's the only reason I'm going, is for Schadenfreude to see how they're...
Just to see how it works.
That's why I went to yours.
What the hell is this going to work?
Anyway, sorry.
There's a film called Bubba Hotep, a Don Coscarelli film. He did Phantasm and I don't know if he's B movie. He's anyway horror director. He did this film Bubba Hotep, which was Bruce Campbell, who is obviously Ash in Evil Dead, played an elderly Elvis who had faked his own death to get out of the spotlight, and then was now in a nursing home and had to fight a mummy that was stealing the souls of the other residents.
Classic.
Yeah. So I saw this film and I loved it. And I was just doing a gig and I was talking to two of the other acts actually, Ian Hall and Liam Mackay, and we were just talking about that film, and then we got onto Evil Dead, and then I don't know whether it was Ian or Leanne, but one of them said that I bore a resemblance to Bruce Campbell, and then we sort of laughed like, "Oh, what can you do with that?" And then we didn't really go into the sort of the depth of it, but like, what could you do? Oh, I could do, you know, well, I don't know. It was like, you do an Evil Dead show. And yeah. I'm like, oh, cool. And we laughed and joked about it, you know, dumb pre-gig. I would say green room, but there wasn't a green, you know, it wasn't a green room conversation. It was a in the crowd conversation pre-show. And then we left it at that, but it sort of, dots were connected, and I had a little sort of kernel of an idea in my mind, and that was sort of 5.5 years ago now. 5.5 years? Yeah, 5.5 years. And then I sort of sat on that idea for 2.5 years, just with it percolating.
So at this point, the idea is literally do an Evil Dead show.
Oh no! Okay. It was the dots between that and the Elvis, because okay. Him playing Elvis, yeah, had been connected. But like, huh? How am I going to do that? So I wrote a couple of sample lyrics, like how it could possibly work, and I started keeping little notes. But I wasn't really working on it. You know, I didn't really give it any too much effort. And then about 2.5 years after that, I started working on it in earnest, because I'd booked it into the Leicester Comedy Festival 6 months before that festival. It was the 2016 one, yeah. And time got closer, because what it was, I registered two shows. I registered my first sort of, let's call it an hour, which it wasn't. It was 40 minutes that I'd done elsewhere that I wanted to extend into an hour. And I thought, I've nearly done all the work on that. I can't just do that. That's cheating. So I registered this idea as well, Elvis Dead. And then in the 6 months, I realised that with the job and trying to write two shows, finish one show, write another one from scratch, that it was just not enough time. So I pulled Elvis Dead that year. And honestly, I'm glad, because it gave me that extra 12 months to work on it that made it into the show that it is. Or rather, the root show, you know, that has grown into the sort of more developed version of it now.
So the show you finished the 40 minute show.
I finished it to an hour. Yeah, I made it into an hour.
And what became of that? Like, how was that received?
Now you've asked, so I can tell you that it was nominated for best debut at the Leicester Comedy Festival.
Didn't know that, but okay.
Best new show.
Yeah. Whenever you Google you, it's very hard to find anything other than the album. No, I'm completely honest with you. I don't mean that in a nasty way. It's just,
no. It's true.
No one gives a shit about.
No, it's true. I discovered, someone pointed out to me the other day that Elvis Dead has got its own Wikipedia page.
Yeah, it has. I
haven't got a Wikipedia page.
No, you haven't. It doesn't even have your name in red. Like someone, maybe make that at some point. Everyone's no one gives a crap.
No, what will be. No, yeah. I'm happy. Like, I don't. Part of me doesn't want this to be my sole legacy. Wanky.
No. I get it.
What I mean? But how ungrateful would it be for me to not? There's so many sort of parallels between it and what my experience and the experience of Bruce Campbell, insofar as, you know, it would have been so easy for him to resent the fact that he's so closely linked to Evil Dead that he can't escape it, and yet he doesn't, because I think he recognises that he wouldn't be where he is were it not for it. And I think that's a very important lesson to be sort of taken on board. And I can't be. And I, by the way, this isn't even in my head, really, but I'm well aware that I can't be ungrateful or even sort of embittered towards any impact this has on my future career. Because if I do become the movie mashup guy, ultimately, or just known solely for Elvis Dead, even that, you know, then I mean, it's not my dream to, I'd like to flourish in numerous directions, but if that's what it is, then I could still be working in a school, you know, and that's, and no disrespect to anybody who is, because you know, no, you
we've
know,
got a hardcore listenership of teachers.
You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm just, it's yeah. This is getting pretending to be Elvis every night and Ash Williams every night is a nice way to spend your time, you know.
For you, you know, not
for me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm not necessarily saying that it's for everyone. Yeah. It's not necessarily for everyone.
Okay, so let's fast forward then. So you're at the Fringe, right? At what point in that run was there a tipping point? Because I'm assuming that, you know, you're, like you say, you're at a midnight slot in a very lovely venue. So it's not like you haven't got sort of a bit of backing there. You haven't got a name to yourself. And I mean that in a most respectful way.
I'm not insulted in the slightest by that, Simon.
No, I know. You, you know, when you have people on this and you go, you're not really a name, but let's... no, but you haven't got... your name isn't selling the tickets as such at this point.
No,
right?
It is not.
So I'm assuming first night or first two nights, it's not selling out?
First night, it was full.
Okay.
First night, it was full. Although, I did recognise most
Humble
of the faces.
No, got it right.
I'm correcting you for the record.
That's fine, that's fine.
I mean, after that first night, it was not so full.
Okay.
And I don't think that was in reaction. It was just that...
Friends.
It was friends. It was the audience was... After the reception at Leicester, presumably it had filtered through to some quarters, and then they said, oh, well, we're in Edinburgh. It's the early part of the Fringe. Nothing's it hasn't really kicked into a gear. We'll just catch that nice and early, or late.
Yeah.
So the first night was full and actually really nice because of the fact that it was mostly faces I knew. And then there was a lull after that. I mean, I could probably get the sales figures up if you want.
It's not about that. It's about what I'm wondering. There's an outside perception of hit shows that they're just selling out every night. You don't have to flyer. Everything's just going well for you. Industry are cramming themselves in, and you know they're going for comps, but they're having to stand at the back. You know, all these sort of weird rumors that I'm sure you've heard from other shows, and I've heard from other shows that are sort of misconceptions. I feel about how a show progresses, especially over the course of this month.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm wondering, from your perspective, how the audience numbers went and whether there was a tipping point where, for example, from like a certain point, you were just sold out because of the award nomination or because a social media influencer tweeted something or because, do you know what I mean? Like, what was a selling point more than you standing outside holding flyers?
Okay, so there was a really quite early on, actually, this might even be the thing that sort of, I don't know, really quite early on, I bumped into Nick Helm at the Pleasance Dome, and I knew he was an Evil Dead fan. So I went over to tell him. I didn't know him, but I went over to say, you know, I've got this. I'll tell you what it was. I was doing there was a show that was about... Dawn of the Dead with a live accompaniment. Was it Dawn of the Dead? I think it was Dawn of the Dead. And so we did a sort of a cross
promotion
thing where I was sort of running through the streets trying to clear the people from this horde of zombies that were coming. Mm. So we had, and then people were flying at the same time.
Yep.
And I don't know how successful that actually was, but I was in the Pleasance Dome dressed in my gear, ready to go, and obviously that kind of gave me more of an in than if I'd have, you know, been just dressed as me. So I spoke to him about it, and then he said he was up for it, and I don't know whether he mentioned that to anybody. One of the early nights after the show, my mum was here, and she went because of the mess I make, she went to go and find a dustpan and brush.
Oh.
And she went upstairs, and she was... She won't thank me for this, but I mean, she's not a drinker, but she was a little bit tipsy.
Mm.
And she saw Ed Byrne upstairs waiting to go on. That wouldn't have been ACMS, I don't think. Was it the Asylum? Or would it have been ACMS? The show that was on upstairs. And so she got this dustpan, went over and spoke to him. And then went downstairs and was like, oh, I've just met Ed Byrne, you know. And then she said, go and say hello, because I say she was a bit tipsy, a bit more sort of bold than she might have otherwise. And I was like, no, she's go on, go and say hello. Oh, in the meantime, he'd asked her, said, oh, what are you here for? And she said, oh, my son's just done a show downstairs. And then, so I went upstairs, fully
Elvis up,
end of the show, beaten up, covered in goo and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, oh, hello, my mum just said she's just met you. I've come to meet you too. And he was like, oh, cool. And then we chatted about that, and he was sort of interested in the concept of the show. And then he came a few days later, and then of course he and Dara Abrin sort of tweeted about it and stayed and took photos wearing the chainsaw and everything. And it was so I don't know whether that had an impact. I mean, I'm certain it did, because there were quite a few comedians that I knew and didn't know who came. When I say knew, I mean like knew their faces. And then someone would tell me afterwards, oh, so and so was in. And I don't know. It's alchemy, isn't it? You don't know how it works. So I say there was the first day was full. There was a drop off after that for a couple of days that were. It was never single figures, but it was quite low. You know,
would it work with a single figure audience? Would it work with like three people in the room?
Well, I've done it to four.
Okay.
And that was fine.
Okay.
I mean, you've just
how do you deal with that? Do you deal with it as in like you're just doing a performance and they happen to be incidentally in the room, or do you incorporate, acknowledge it?
Well, because I mean, there are elements of the show that are quite interactive anyway. So that doesn't change. You know. Obviously, there will become a minimum. There is a minimum amount, because otherwise you're kind of hassling this person with all of the bits that you would do to different people across the room. And that, I had a friend when I was doing it in Birmingham one time. He said, I'm going to buy all the tickets and it'll just be me. And I said, all right, let's see what it gets weird for first.
Yeah.
Because I'll just be singing directly to you. Yeah. Let's see how it gets. See how weird it gets. So I've done it to four. I've done it to six, and I'll do it. I will do it, because I mean, there's a.
It's your job.
It's my job. It's
Why
don't they deserve the show?
No, I know what you mean, but it's
you know.
I mean, I'll give you an example. I did a preview 2 days ago. And I had three people in the room. And before I went on, I spoke to the tech and I was like, this is going to be fucking awful. Like, this is not going to work. Partly because, like you say, I have a few bits where I, you know, do like a kind of rhetorical question, but it kind of requires an answer to keep the narrative going, really, right? And I was just worried about it. They were lovely. Like, they were the most magic audience I've had in a while, because they were up for it. They all sort of had their own little in jokes. They had little moments where if you mentioned something, they'd go like nudge each other and be like, that's you, that is, that kind of thing. But they didn't talk, they just carried on with the nudge. So it was so good. And it really made me go, right, okay, if you have an audience of one or three or two, or however many is in this run of Edinburgh, don't write them off.
You don't know.
Because you don't know. Even though I was like, it's too small to do the show to.
Yeah.
But the problem is like, I mean, I have friends who are musicians and like, you know, buskers and things. And busking's different. Busking you can kind of do when there's only one person watching you, because you're doing it and everyone's just walking past. But I feel like as a musician, it must be, like you say, quite weird to serenade a person, unless you're in love with them, and they're kind of used to the eye contact.
Outside their window.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, fine. We'll talk about that in a second. No, but you know what I mean? Like, I suppose there's an undue amount of pressure on them to enjoy it when you're like,
yeah,
right, let's do this eye contact.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not fair because it's not fair on you. It's not fair on them.
Mm.
There's, like you say, there's, and then they're going to feel like they can't leave as well, which I don't ever want to feel like I'm holding an audience hostage. You know, if you're not enjoying it, why would you put yourself through it? And you know, let's all be honest with each other, and you know, cut our losses when it, you know, I had a preview of the new show. I drove to York and found the audience to be four people. And
one up on me, mate. That's fine.
I'm doing all right, mate.
Yeah, I'm doing all right. That name's pulling in the name.
And They were lovely. They were so nice. They were so nice to the point where they indulged me in a a Q&A to them. They weren't asking me things. I was asking them about what they'd just seen, like whether they understood what I was trying to do and whether they saw connections in things that I'd that perhaps weren't like signposted, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I get you.
And that, so that was...
That's always useful.
It was really educational. Yeah. Yeah, it was like really, really educational for me because there was a... yeah, there was one specific thing that I want people's attention to be drawn to, and it wasn't working. I mean, like I say, one particular preview, and so then on their advice, I spoke to a friend of mine who, I'm not saying I fixed it. We don't know yet. I haven't done it yet.
Yeah, jury's out.
But I have taken no advice on how to hopefully draw someone's attention to a factor. Don't write an audience off. Yeah, yeah. That's a very wise and hopeful, optimistic position to take.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I now break up my year into tour from like September to November, and then I'd sort of take December off to have an idea and then start again. But in January and February, I list previews as focus groups. So the idea is that people come in and they're aware just from the title that there is going to be me doing a Q&A to them at the end. And that way, when it becomes the preview time in like March onwards, so we're talking Leicester Festival, Glasgow, that sort of thing onwards, it's not Q&A time, like sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's really helpful to kind of, because there's two jokes in this current show where I hadn't made a connection and it wasn't working. And I remember saying to them, you know, have you got any feedback? And one person just put their hand up and just said, I think you're fucking your mum. And I was like, what? And they went, yeah, the way you phrased that, I think you fucked your mum. And I was like, oh, I'm going to listen to that back. And because you know
and
what I mean?
Did it become obvious as soon as...
Yeah, yeah, as yeah. Soon as you, yeah, ah. Yeah. I have a joke in the show about how my mum has to wear a strap to support her knee. And I joke about how she keeps losing it and you know, saying, oh, why's the dog got the strap on kind of thing. And he mistook it for me thinking that I'm fucking my mum. And so now I've had to rephrase it to make it just much more lightheartedly jovial about, oh, it's just wordplay, rather than him thinking we've got some sort of sexual relationship.
Have you managed to canvass an audience to find out if that's still the case?
I have, yeah.
It's definitely not the case.
Although I don't say that because then they're like, oh, hang on, is that what he's going for? I just say, you know, have you got any feedback? And then go through it and like going, what about this bit? It was this bit. What did you think about that bit? And they go, oh, that's silly. I like that. That's just silly wordplay. So it's okay now. But like, it was just such a weird, you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't have made that connection in a billion years. And like, if I've got Copstick or someone from Broadway Baby in the audience, I don't want them doing that. The last person you want is, you know, that sort
of thing. So next year you're doing your Oedipal.
Yeah, yeah, Oedipal complex. Yeah. That. No, next year, actually, this is probably can't go in, but next year I'm writing a show called Simon Caine Knows Who Shot JFK. And the idea is that I'm going to play a conspiracy theorist who has lost his mind trying to prove that he didn't kill JFK because he found online someone was accusing him of being a time traveler and doing it. So I had to find the truth to clear my name. And it's going to be like, so far I've started writing like the theories and like what's going to happen. I love conspiracy theories and I love just like reading nut jobs online, so writing them has been a lot of fun so far.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Especially as like you can just go, as long as it's got a kernel of internal logic, it doesn't matter because you're a nut job anyway, so they don't don't care that it doesn't properly add up. So I'm having a lot of fun with that.
That sounds great, man.
But anyway, sorry, back to the podcast.
I haven't a clue.
Yeah, we've got a clue who killed JFK.
No, I mean, what to do next?
Well, that was going to be the next bit of the podcast, so I'll just skip.
No. I mean,
you're doing a show this year.
I am doing a show this year.
Called the Wheel of Shows. Wheel of Shows. And that is essentially a load of shows that people can select, like they do the wheel, is that right?
That's the conceit, but it never occurs in
okay.
the show.
So you've rigged it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean the wheel never barely gets used. I shouldn't really be saying that there is one in it because it's initially it's why would I bother making a wheel? It's ridiculous. What sort of an idiot would waste time building a wheel? The wheel of shows I've come to learn through what going around in circles
literally.
Is the calendar. of the it's you're on you've joined the cycle, the merry-go-round of shows, right. You know, and it's that you're on the wheel of shows essentially, and it's not it doesn't end,
right?
You know, I mean, that's in there,
yeah,
for people to see or to not see,
yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And like I say, initially it wasn't initially apparent to me, but then you see and you go, oh no, that makes sense. I'm going to tweak that now so that it's more that,
yeah,
you know. The show is mostly about like sort of procrastination and anxiety over following up something successful.
Okay.
So it's,
how did you have that idea?
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Because I did, I had an idea that I wanted to embrace.
So not the show, a different one.
Because the initial Wheel of Shows pitch for Leicester was just me being a smart ass,
right.
You know, to not commit to a concept. And then the show I was gonna do in Leicester was gonna be a sort of a Twilight Zone episode.
Okay.
Where a man who's recently enjoyed some success is at a crossroads in his life, doesn't know what he's going to do with himself, stumbles into a bookshop, finds a shelf of books that are his life, and then he's got the sort of, he reads about himself, and then he has this sort of moral quandary about sort of seeing where he goes next. And
whoever reads more books, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. It's like, who do you choose, if you had that window and all that sort of stuff. And the upshot of it, the idea of it was that it was, initially when he didn't realise the shelf was his, that he had this, he read about this old man's death and he got no connection to it, and then, or to the people around the bed, and then that he was going to then come back to it, and then it was going to be if nothing else phrased differently, like sort of or spoken differently, so it got more sort of gravitas or sort of significance, and then it becomes more of something probably as twee as your biggest treasure is your family and friends, sort of thing. That's very twee. It's very, very twee. But it was like this sort of, the idea was it was a sort of a Twilight Zone-y thing. And it occurs to me, I am not old enough or have enough life experience or interesting enough to write that show yet.
Right.
Because I was going to fill it full of, you know, true life anecdotes and things, but then I thought, well, hang on a minute, I'm hoping there's a massive chunk of life that I've yet to live,
yeah.
Not that I'm going to do it on my deathbed, but you know what I mean.
That'd be a show. Could you imagine someone wheeled on stage in their deathbed and lift it up and just be like,
do their thing, like, yeah, and then cark it,
yeah.
on their last night. That's the way to end a Fringe. Yeah. No, and you know what's brilliant about that? You don't have to get back on the train. Or you don't have to drive back from Edinburgh because you're dead.
That's amazing. Yeah, they'll do it for you. They'll drive you for you.
Yeah.
So,
fuck
you, Southern Rail. Sorry.
So that was the show that I was trying to write. Failed to write. Wasn't satisfied
shelved
with it.
You shelved it.
I shelved it.
Yeah, because you're going to come back to it probably.
Hopefully, yeah. Maybe. Although I have now told everybody
yeah.
it. So then that got shelved. And I did try another thing, which involved being in prison.
The show,
yeah.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah.
You said about singing outside someone's window. I'm just checking.
Yeah. It was about... the whole conceit of being in prison came from the fact that at the time I was planning to wear a Beetlejuice suit just to troll people into thinking it was Beetlejuice. Okay. So I thought, why would I be wearing a stripy suit? If I'd been to prison.
Right.
Gentleman's prison.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that is never... no one in prison wears a stripy...
Gentleman's prison.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Right. So then that...
Clearly, I go to the riffraff prison.
So then that became a thing for a while. But then again, I realised I was asking too much of the... It was too much of a leap, you know?
Mm.
And then I had this encounter with a friend where I sort of agonised over the show and not working a little bit, and then he put me right, and that became more about the show now, because it really gave me a kick in the arse and a sort of a real... it gave me a shot of perspective.
Mm.
and that really sort of shifted what the show was about, and the wheel of shows. Originally, it was me to avoid having a... have to... But that's even... It's to avoid having a blurb that didn't leave me any wiggle room. That was the original concept. So, cheating it. And then, as it's moved on, it's become sort of totemistic of the pressure to do a thing.
Mm.
The indecision and generally... procrastination.
Mm.
You know, any excuse to not be doing the thing you're supposed to be doing.
Mm.
And so the show is kind of that. I hope it, in one way or another, it's a glimpse into how I've been feeling about it for this past year, if anybody cares.
Well, this was going to be my next question is, and you don't have to be specific about this, but have people moved over from Elvis Dead to this show? Like, are you noticing people tweeting you or buying tickets going, oh, I can't wait to see what Rob's doing next? Or are they just going, oh, great, the Elvis Dead is back?
Elvis Dead guy. Because that was an honest concern of mine.
Mm.
Although I've been assured by a number of people that that's all in my head.
Yeah, but it's going to be in your head.
You can't not...
Yeah, unless you sell out both, it's not going to not be in your head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Am I that guy? Some people... I have had some people say, ah, yeah, we're interested in seeing what this is. And in actual fact, there was a lady who came to a preview who she saw Elvis Dead at Mac, and she was dragged along to it by her friend who was really into both things. She was into Elvis, and she was dragged along to it, and she came to Wheel of Shows just to see what else. Because initially...
What you could do.
Yeah. So I asked her, because we were speaking afterwards, you know, did were you expecting more Elvis Dead? And she said, no, I just wanted to see what you were going to do. And that was heartening to me, because I can't be annoyed at people for maybe making that assumption. Because, I mean, I've had to turn down gigs who assume I'm a musical comedian. In fact, one gig, actually, I was like, oh, no, I'm not bringing Elvis. I won't be doing any Elvis. And I was like, oh, okay. Are you still bringing your guitar, though? And you're going to do I don't do songs. I haven't got any songs. I've got those songs. Mm. And that's a show that doesn't work outside of itself, you know? I've tried to chop it up. It doesn't work out of context. I saw
a video of you doing the Fast Fringe last year. And again, with all respect, I was like, this isn't work. Like, I felt like everyone was just being quiet, wondering what it was.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in an insulting way. As I said, I loved the show. But I just... And honestly, that was when it was the one where you cut off your hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're talking about how you should have favoured you. Like, it's a big whack joke, essentially. Like, it's like, you know,
one part of it is, yes.
Yeah, all right, well, I like that bit the best. Because that's my favourite of all the jokes, okay? I'm a typical middle-class white guy. I like a wanking joke, right?
I mean... Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Sorry. Right. But anyway, my point was, has that been a stumbling block for promoting the show, and has that been a weird thing for people to list you as create of Elvis Dead, And then people come along and you just go up and go, hey guys, so what about the girlfriend. Difference between women?
It's exactly, uh-huh. That might be in my head, but to an extent I am now getting offers of gigs that I don't suit. In fact, here at the Fringe I've been offered sort of spots to go and do sort of some musical showcases to sort of give them a little snippet. You do know it's this thing, it's only this thing, it doesn't work out of context, I'm not that guy, you know. So it has impacted to an extent.
Is that frustrating?
Yeah, I mean,
would you want to do the gig?
I feel like I want to change the tone of my yeah, because I felt it was a bit too emphatic. Okay. And I mean, it is annoying. Of course it's annoying, because you sort of think, well, so I've managed to achieve something to a certain level, but I've still got to break out of the confines of this thing before anybody will see me as anything other than that. Mm. You know, and again, I don't know, maybe in my head, probably most people don't care.
Mm. And this is a semi-personal question, but I presume that a certain amount of your income comes from doing that show at this point.
Yeah.
So there's a dichotomy of, you don't want to be seen as that, but if you break away, you're taking a risk of losing a chunk of money and maybe having to go back to a day job and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I don't know how you perceive day jobs. When I spoke to Beck Hill about this, you know, she was very like, I loved my day job, I loved the people I worked with, I didn't want to have a day job, but the fact that I got on with them and it was useful to kind of cushion me so I didn't have to worry so much about selling out gigs and stuff, mm-hmm. it was helpful. And I know a lot of comedians who see their job like that. So I don't know if you saw it as a hindrance, because it sounds like it was actually quite good to work around for Edinburgh and for comedy and things like that.
To an extent, although it because of the busiest time of an exams officer being April, May, June, and well, it's all wind up from January until the end of June. It makes it difficult to gig in those periods, and like that, one of the reasons why I left that job was because I wasn't available for things. You know, I wanted to be available to go and travel to wherever to do the show. So I'm not against. I will happily bolster my income with another job, because that's what this is. You know, I mean, it is a job, isn't it? Ultimately, I'll bolster it with a slightly less showbiz job. But obviously, it's going to have to be a job where there's a flexibility of, you know, being able to. I need to get to the other side of the country, so I'm going to have to leave at lunchtime, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah, I get
it. I think I'm fairly easy to get on with, so I
didn't know where that was going, sorry. That was why.
No, in terms of, so I don't know whether that's, I don't know whether, I've always got on with my colleagues. Mm. I mean, once previously when I was an electrician, there was, there's a lot of machismo and testosterone floating around on building sites. So I didn't get on with everybody.
Yeah.
You know, because some people are bell ends.
Yeah, that's fair.
But by and large, I've always gotten on with my work colleagues.
Mm. Well, one of the things you said that I found really interesting was where you said, I'm not a music act, or I'm not a musician, or that sort of thing. And I know you have been a musician.
I've been in bands, yeah.
Yeah, but also...
But I was only a... See, my friend Greg, who is a guitarist of... He's Johnny B. Good. He can play... He's done a music degree since, so he's learned all about theory. But initially, when he was playing, he was all ear stuff, so he could just pick up a guitar, pick up a tune, and he's brilliant. And I've been in a band with him, and he told me off for referring to the voice as not an instrument.
Yeah, I could see why he would do that.
And he's very...
I think he's right.
He's very strong. So whenever I say, I'm just the singer, you know, and he'd go, no, what you're doing is very important. And so, yes, in those terms, I am a musician. Mm. I used to play the organ as a kid. Don't smirk. I did. You did smirk. I saw you smirk.
Because you smirked. I'm hoping he's not going.
Night, I play with my organ every night.
Good. How old were you?
I was. It was between sort of 6 and 16. I think it was. Mm-hmm. Was it 16?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, and then I realised that there were other things to do with my time.
Then play with your organ.
And then play with my organ. Yeah. And I'm a terrible guitarist. I'm trying. I'm still trying, but other things are afoot. So yeah, what was the question?
I didn't finish it. You jumped in, and
sorry.
Well, the thing that really stood out to me about the show, like the thing that really I remembered. So for me, when I'm structuring a show, the hard part is the ending for me, because I always want that to. I feel like you're always going to remember that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like whether it's shit or good, it's sort of the moment that most people remember the most, because it's the most recent part of it.
Yeah.
And the opening bit, which I always used to think was where I had to set up for the ending, but now I sort of wait 5 minutes in. On yours, what really stood out was where you go on stage kind of as Rob, if you like. At this point, you're not, as I said, I don't know how I'm going to say character, but you're not whoever that is on stage. And then you go, treat it as a concert. Just treat it as a concert, kind of. And that's not your first line, but that's its essence of what you say. So I'm wondering whether that has embedded in the industry that you want, like you want this to be perceived more as a musical, like a musical theatre that's funny, or whether you saw it always as a comedy show that stand up with, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm wondering how you perceived it when you were saying that, or when you say that line.
Because that wasn't, that until I knew that that was what people needed, because audiences are sometimes reserved, you know, they don't know that that's encouraged, and nothing makes me happier when I'm doing the show when someone does unprompted do the backing, you know,
right.
Or, you know, starts clapping along.
Yeah.
In time. It's very important, guys.
Yeah. Hands are an instrument too, guys.
So I put that in there in order to sort of hopefully loosen them up. It's not meant to be a final word on what I'm doing as much as it's meant to be. It's for them. It's for the audience to relax into. Ah, I'm not on edge. I'm not, you know, this is also, I think if somebody's turned up and they're expecting it to be maybe a song, and then I'm going to talk about Elvis for 10 minutes with hilarious anecdotes, and then do a song and then talk about Evil Dead no, guys, it's not going to be that.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose I'd put it under comedy just because that feels, I kind of feel like that's the field I'm working in, and it was intended to be funny. So when you say, is it still comedy? Yeah.
No, but I mean, it blends a lot of genres and it blends a lot of different types of media. So I was wondering, just especially as you were saying that you're getting booked for like musical comedy gigs and things like that, I was wondering whether that is because of the way you present it, or the way that it's being presented, especially from the off.
Well, that's not a question I can answer, Simon.
All right.
That's that.
But they might have emailed back just going, I thought you were a musician because I saw you do an hour of song. You know, that sort of thing. I'm sure you've never got that exact email.
No, of course.
You dickhead.
I mean, if I'd have known the answers to these questions in advance, then I'd have probably still done the show out of bloody mindedness and my own love of those two things. However, that these questions are kind of leading into my current quandary about who I am, what I am, where I'm going, what I need to do to get, like, to not be, not typecast, that's the wrong word, but you know. Do you know what I find really odd? And I know, I appreciate that if somebody writes a certain way, they go, ah, I write one-line jokes. You know, that's my thing. That's what I do. Why? People seem very intent upon being classified in a box. You know, that person does one-liners. This person does, you know, angry. Or is it? No, you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
No, you know what I mean.
Bill Burr kind of thing.
Yeah, sort of enraged. Or, you know, this person is always whimsical. This person's musical. Why? Why is that?
I don't think that's a comedian thing. I think that's the industry, because it's easier to sell someone.
Oh, it is easy to sell. Yeah. No, fair. That's
so
fair.
I personally don't want to be boxed. But whenever I've chatted to two agents in the last 3 months, and both of them have said, you know, like,
what do you do?
What do you do?
Who are you? What do you do?
Well, no, like, one of them saw my show and then went, oh, what do you do? And I was like, really? Like, you, It was an hour of that.
You were just in there.
But then they followed it up with just like, no, we know you're funny. We've come down. We know you're funny. But we're just wondering what else you do.
What other strings you've got to your bow.
And can we sell that? Because at the moment, it's funny, but it's you're just, you know, you blend in very nicely to a lot of other type of people that look like you and act like you and do a very, not a similar thing, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not an insult to you. It's just them saying, we are trying to do a business here. We need to know how to sell it. And with yours, obviously, there's a very easy pitch now, or at least I feel like the pitch is easier now for them to say, I mean, forget about all the awards and stuff, for you to go to a conference place and say, I tell the story of Elvis, sorry, Evil Dead 2, through the eyes, if you like, or through the stylings of Elvis. And there's certain conferences and not conferences, conventions that easily would go, well, yeah, why would we not have that? Like, that seems like it would work. And I suppose that leads in nicely to the whole idea about what is the convention scene like versus the festival scene that you've been doing?
Good. No,
is there any difference?
A convention performance isn't necessarily set up in the best environment for comedy.
Right.
You know, sometimes you will be in a wide open space with tables that are far away from the audience, and it'll often be in like a cavernous sort of part of a hall. Something will be going on the other side. Mm. I mean, occasionally you get put into a room on your own little room, but then of course you've then got to hope that people come up to it.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a different time of the day as well, like, because generally that shows, I mean, the Fringe especially, it's late.
A late show.
Yeah. So, but it could be at 2 PM if it's a day convention, I suppose.
Yeah.
How does that affect the show?
I mean, when you've done it in, you know, bright lights and without any of the, the mood setting, it still works. I'm not, you know, I think it's because the audience will react to the, they become, if you started the show and it was dark and moody and hazy and, you know, there was all this sort of horror affectations, and then they were stripped away and suddenly you're in a brightly lit cavernous room, that would be difficult. I think that would be a gear change. Not that's ever going to happen, but you know, you adjust to what you've got, don't you? You adjust to what you've seen and what you've got. So it doesn't change it that much. I suppose it changes the awakeness, alertness of the audience, and how drunk they are.
Would you ever, to detach yourself from it, would you ever, like, franchise it out to have someone else play the lead, if you like? Like, have you ever thought about basically not being in it and then just having a writing credit for it, sort of thing?
I think that's... ultimately, why not? I mean, there's going to come a point... I mean, this is theorising that the show has a long enough life. But there's going to come a point, if it does, where I'm, too grey and leathery, and too paunchy to convincingly be not necessarily late stage Elvis, but Ash. Because at the moment, I think straddling the line is quite important. And even though he, through the TV show, eventually becomes the leathery, paunchy, you know. Middle-aged, I would, but I feel like I need to do more with it first.
I get you.
You know, I mean, if this show got franchised and taken further and further, and then started doing big places, like big places, and like the Vegas show that I dream of, I would be gutted that it wasn't me doing that. Although there is something to be said, you know, maybe the next person would be better. I mean, I prefer the Jimi Hendrix All Along the Watchtower, so you know, it's subjective. You don't necessarily have to like the person who wrote a thing. Interpretations and what have you.
Do you think, because this was a sort of side question that you sort of touched upon, so I will ask it. Have
because you're playing two characters from two different things, who have, you know, there's crossover to the looks and stuff. Has that affected, so have you had to, like, make sure you stay a certain shape or, like, have the sideburns or, like, do you know what I mean? Like, is there a certain element of it beyond the Elvis-y shirt and so, you know what I mean, that you've had to work around and stay in a certain way?
I've for the past 18 months, I've gone into the same hairdresser and asked for the same haircut. Every time, I mean, this isn't a criticism of her, but every time she says, "Hey, what grade was it on the science?" You know, and it's become a running joke, you know. Yeah.
Does she know the show? She knows why you're doing it.
She knows why. Yeah. She hasn't seen it, but she knows why. That was an odd series of months when we were, you know how normally it's, oh yeah, where are you going on holiday? Mm. No, the topic of conversation was all about Edinburgh and everything and how am I doing and all that stuff. So, so that was quite nice. Yeah, so I have a haircut to maintain. ridiculous. I like to try to be relatively clean shaven for the show. Because, well, for obvious reasons, both of them were relatively clean. I mean, there's definite stubble in Ashy's case. Yeah, so there's that. I don't think there's any particular pressure in terms of physique, because it's not like Ash was ever painted as being like a super buff strongman. And because of the time frame for Elvis, again, whilst he may have had those, you know, film roles where he was buff, people are a bit more forgiving of.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I was just wondering if it was a factor. Like, I wondered if it had come in your head where you're like, I'm playing these two parts, and I obviously can't, you know, I can't dye my hair blue, for example,
of course,
because, you know, not saying that's what you wanted to do, but it's linked into what I perceive when you said before, where, you know, it's what you're getting known for, or what you are becoming known for. Yeah. It's kind of taking over more than just your professional life, because it would eke into your personal life in that way.
Yeah, yeah. Insofar as I've got to maintain a haircut. Yeah.
And, I didn't know it'd just be that, but yeah.
I mean, previously when I've come up to the fringe, I haven't been backward in heading to the bar.
Mm.
You know, but I am conscious that my voice is important to me now, more than just croaking out some jokes. And that, again, that's not an insult to anybody who doesn't have to worry about that. But I am conscious of the fact that singing solidly for an hour every night is, give or take, it's going to put some demands on your voice. So. I'm drinking less than I would, so that's not necessarily a lifestyle thing. I'm thinking about that, and I am a tea machine. I do love a cup of tea, and dairy's not good for singing either. So, so you know, choosing when to sort of be the cutoff point.
Yeah,
you know, with that sort of thing. But no, overall. It's fairly. I mean, it has impacted my life insofar as I'm still making the plates for the show, the breakable plates, because I don't have the budget for the theatre ones.
Right.
I don't at present. I mean, fingers crossed, eh?
That's interesting. How expensive are the theatre ones?
Well, I'm not going to say that. I haven't got it on update and notification.
No.
But the one time that I looked into it, the cheapest I could find them for. Without bulk buying, because at the time I didn't know how many shows I was going to need to do. £11 each. Now, I don't...
That's more than a regular plate. Yeah.
Well, because it's got to break safely, hasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose.
You know, I could smash, you know, as the plates over my head and then cut my arms up when I'm crawling around on the floor in it.
Save you on blood. Save on fighting.
Oh, man, why didn't I think of that?
This is why you need a director, mate. This is why I've got you here.
You're right. Yeah, it's like using real bullets.
Yeah.
For the
just
extras.
To save. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm still making the plates. So that's kind of become an ongoing part of my... Not necessarily...
Your 10% a plate-making machine, like, sort of. Yeah,
it's not every day. Well, I know when you're talking about body and appearance, what I mean is in terms of things that I've had to incorporate into my life, you know, in terms of making sure I've got enough for the next thing. So I've got to factor that into my... I know that wasn't the question.
No.
But it is something that I've now absorbed into my...
It's interesting in this, in a sense,
Yeah.
Okay, final question. Mm-hmm. What is... Actually, final two questions. What is the... Actually, I've just realised by saying it that way, it sounds like this is the... Do that again, right? What is the best and worst thing that's come out of this show for you?
Okay, let's get soppy. The best, it's not, unfortunately not very industry, I'm afraid. The best is the fact that through the nomination for the show, I met my girlfriend.
Oh, that's sweet.
So yeah, that's probably the best thing that's...
It wasn't Nina, like Anika Burns. It wasn't like the running the award person.
Yes.
Okay. This is where we find out how you really won it.
Yeah. Okay. So that's... Because, I mean, that's a tough question. That's a big ask, really. I mean, there's so many lovely things and so many great things have happened. That's she's probably the biggest thing. Because it's... Yeah. Great. Worst thing, I mean, we've probably already touched on it. The worst thing isn't even that bad. It's just I'm now uncertain as to how I'm perceived and whether that now is going to be my lot, you know? Yeah.
Like a one-hit wonder type thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's okay. As I say, you know, there are worse things than being... There are worse things in life than being Lou Bega.
Yeah.
You know?
He's not a one-hit... I've got his whole album.
Name me two songs.
Mambo Number 4.
Mambo Number 4. Of course it is, yeah.
The album is pretty obvious, if you... Like,
it's just one. How many song. Tracks are there? Yeah, there are 10 tracks. What's the last track? Mambo Number 10.
Mambo Number 10, yeah. It's a bonus one.
Yeah, there's worse things.
Yeah.
So it's uncertainty, but then I had it pointed out to me just recently by another act that uncertainty is my whole thing. It's what apparently it's what I do.
Yeah.
So that's
you should be used to it.
Maybe I can maybe I can embrace this. I don't know. It has occurred to me that being a comedian, being a devil's advocate, able to see both sides of most arguments kind of guy, isn't very helpful for a comedian.
No.
Not at all.
No.
I always find myself in positions where I'm going, well, this, but then maybe that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's good. He just cut you up, but he might not know the roads.
Yeah.
He might not know the roads. He didn't. I don't think. Imagine if you were in another city that you didn't know.
Yeah.
You might cut someone up accidentally, and you don't want them to hate you.
Also, he might just want to pass on his anger, so he doesn't have it anymore. You don't know.
I don't know.
You're being unselfish by not taking that.
I'm
anger
a. On. Oh wait, what? I'm a sort of anger, that's a rage conduit.
Yeah, I always assume that someone's just having a bad day and they don't want to have it anymore, so they're passing it on to me when they cut me up. Like they're just going, you take that now and pass it on if you want to.
Yeah. Imagine if you don't and you become like a well for rage.
You become Bill Burr.
You become Bill Burr. Yeah, you do.
Just get angry. Right, absolute last question. If you could go... Right, the normal question for this is if you could go back to the start of your career and give yourself one bit of advice, what would it be? Mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of rephrase it and say, if you could go back to that dressing room where you were talking to those other two comedians and having the kernel of the idea and you could tell your past self one bit of advice... that would maybe have been helpful or just calmed you down or you know, just sort of guided you a bit better than what you maybe went through. What would that be?
The fairly... I suppose I would say don't leave it till the last minute. Because I was working on it, but there was things that were just left so late before that first Leicester performance. Yeah, like... get on with it, mate. You know. Also, don't rush it, which is, I know, sounds so contradictory,
yeah.
but it's not.
You're taking both sides.
Yeah, no, it's not contradictory. What I mean is, don't muck about, don't waste your time, and don't leave it to the last minute. But also, you don't necessarily have to get it out tomorrow. So when it comes to that first time, don't go, well, this will do. No, get it right. I am the future you, and you, I am depending on you. Probably that. Also, practice your falling.
Right.
Practice your falling over, because that's going to be important to you soon. I think the thing that I would probably tell myself, not necessarily if I did go all the way back, I would say the idea can be king. You know, you don't necessarily. There's a Midlands act that he seems sort of set on the idea that marketing a thing is key. And I'm not saying it's not, but I mean if this whole story of where I've gotten through to with Elvis Dead is any kind of vindication for any kind of stance, it's that the idea was king. I mean, it didn't hurt that I had a beautiful poster that perfectly, which is marketing. I'm well aware. Yeah. I do know that. But what I mean is, I reckon I could pitch that show to people. Marketing, that's still pitching, isn't it?
Yeah.
What I mean is,
word of mouth. Yeah. Which is still marketing, but I think it's not quite the same.
But it's not quite the same. Yeah. I don't think there's quite as much. There's less business investment.
You can't buy that.
You can't. So you have to earn it. And I think I feel like that. I'm, or at least this show is proof positive that if your idea is strong enough, this all sounds so self-backslash. I'm sort of self-aggrandizing it, and I'm not. I don't mean like that. I'm trying. This is what I was. If I'd have won the Edinburgh Fringe Award, this is what I was. I sort of thought, what would you say? What on earth would you say to people? I'll tell all the weirdos that their stupid idea is worth pursuing. You know, there's more. Do pursue it, because the idea is the thing. You know, of course that might then open
Pandora's box.
Younger me might then start developing all the really stupid ideas he's had, and the world doesn't need that.
No. Okay, thank you for coming on.
My pleasure, man. My pleasure.
That was Rob. I love talking to him about the future of the Elvis Dead show, but also his own career. I get his anxiety and worry, not at the same level, of course, but of where his success is going to lead him, but also the pressure of an awkward second show, and if he'll be forever typecast in the role of the music media mashup guy, which, as he said, isn't the worst thing in the world, but is it all he wants to do? I don't know. Doesn't sound like it's everything he has, but it does sound like something he might work on in the future. Also, his thoughts on awards and which ones made a difference to him personally and professionally. And there were some unusual answers in there that I wasn't quite expecting. So for me, that's the most interesting part, is hearing secondhand, through his own words, what awards gave him the boost that made his career go up a level, up a notch, and helped him move forward within the circuits that he's running in, which is largely the convention circuit, and also festivals, taking that show around the country. If you like this episode, you might also enjoy my interview with Louisa O'Malley, which was recorded just after her amazingly successful debut hour at the Edinburgh Festival, called What Would Beyonce Do? If you just scroll back, I think it's like episode 12. If you ever listen back to that, that's another very good interview on the same lines as this one. If you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. 5 stars would be the dream, but if not, a 4-star rating with a review that reads like a 5-star is just as good. And either way, please do consider giving us a donation to keep the podcast going. You can either do this on PayPal at simonkane.co.uk or on Patreon at patreon.com/AskTheIndustryPodcast. All donations, no matter how big or small, really help the project continue. So if this was worth 80p, 20 quid, £100 of your money, please do donate it to me if you can. From the bottom of my heart, I appreciate all donations, and I can't thank the people enough who do it intermittently to help this show out. As I've said to a few people who've emailed recently, I don't break even on these podcasts by a long chalk. So if you want to help support me around the Christmas period, then I would really appreciate a little bit of money just thrown my way if you can. If you can't, I understand money's tight at this time of year, but it's also the time where people are generous sometimes. So if you want to give me a quid or two or 20 would be nice, then please do consider doing that. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Before you go, I just want to quickly say I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival. I'm drilling down the details on dates, times, and all that sort of stuff. But just so you're aware, I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival in 2019. I'm also going to be previewing the show from about April onwards around the country. And then I'm going to be on tour in September and October. Now, this is the most vague plug I've done for anything, but essentially I'm going to be updating my website with these details as soon as they are available. Please do keep an eye out for them. I'd really appreciate it, as that would really help. The one thing I can confirm is I am doing a one-off, potentially DVD record. Again, that is something I'm dealing with. I'm sorting it out. Of Sex, Drugs and Other Things I Never Do at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London on the 21st of March 2019. If you can come to that, please do. If you would like to get half off the tickets, tweet me something mysterious like my favourite macaroon is strawberry flavoured, right? Tweet me that and I would DM you the discount code so you can get money off your tickets to come and see that show live. I'd really love to get some of your listeners in and to watch the show. I'm really, really excited about it, but also really nervous about it, as it's quite a big space, even though it's the studio space. But yeah, I want to get the thing recorded and out the door. So if you can come, please do. If you can't come, please tell a friend and hopefully they'll come. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.